Okay, so I wanted to talk about some simulations of the Sinyasa-Lobovitch effects that we've been doing at Harvard. And the point of this talk is partly advertising because we're not done yet. We're still halfway through the analysis. But I want to convince you that even though no papers have come out, we're all working very, very, very hard. We, in this particular context, is Volker Springle, who's a postdoc at the CFA, Lars Hernquist, and myself. And for some of the work I'll be talking about when I get into some of the preheating and injection models, Chris Metzler, who's also a postdoc at the CFA, has been working on a sort of side project. There is no introduction. This is an expert audience, so we can skip straight over that. I'll briefly mention the simulations. I won't spend any time at all describing the codes because, frankly, only a mother could love them. I'll talk a little bit about the basic results. That, in this particular context, means adiabatic simulations. And what I'm going to try and convince you of is that we believe that we can simulate the Sinyasa-Lobovitch effects, assuming there's nothing going on except adiabatic gas physics. I do not believe anyone else has actually demonstrated that, you know, to the level we have. It's only somewhat of academic interest, but I believe that if you can't convince yourself of this, there's no point in doing anything else. And then I'll talk about a few things that we're trying to do on the anything else category. And this is where it really becomes very much work in progress. So you run through some of the simulations. We do all of this in a fixed cosmology. So there's only one cosmology, and we don't vary it at all. It's the Ostreicher and Steinhardt concordance model. It's your kind of favorite lambda CDM model with omega matter of 0.3, 4% baryons, and all the other usual parameters. And then we did a sequence of runs. The base run, which I'll keep referring back to, is 134A. It's a 20 million particle SPH simulation. In a 200 megaparsec box, that gives you a dark matter mass of around about a few times 10 to the 10, a gas mass of a few times 10 to the 9. The dynamic range in linear scale is about 15,000. The highest density objects we see in the simulation are 10 to the 9 times the background density. Starting at redshift 19, we start dumping full box outputs every light crossing time of the box. There's 332 dumps between redshift 0 and 19, and that's the primary data set from which we make all of our maps and everything. We wanted to do a convergence study, so what we did was we ran a box that was exactly the same as the above, except it was half as big in linear size, so that gives us twice as high linear force accuracy and 8 times as much mass resolution. You can work out the numbers yourself. That turned out to be very, very useful. I'll talk a little bit about this energy injection run. What we wanted to do was study a whole bunch of different things, and the first thing we wanted to do was essentially bracket the problem. So we wanted to do something with absolutely no energy injection. That's obviously this run. And then we wanted to do something with so much energy injection that we would clearly get an upper limit. We succeeded beyond our wildest dreams. We came up with a model that's absolutely, completely, totally, hopelessly ruled out and bizarre, but it does give an upper limit. This is 134B. It's exactly the same as this one, except at redshift 7, we dumped 1 keV of energy into all of the gas in the box. And I'll show you a picture. It's incredibly dramatic. And we'll run through the analysis. We also have a whole bunch of other things that are slightly more reasonable. They're not analyzed. And partly the reason for that is that this is a fairly large data set. There's over a terabyte of data here. And all the analysis is being done on 4 little workstations. And getting anything on and off the tape and shuffling them around the disk is a right royal pain in the neck. And so we've been trying to keep the number of individual data sets we're looking at any one time down to a minimum. And so these three have already filled up our 500 gigabytes of local disk, and everything else is being staged off of tapes. The really interesting stuff is the stuff, unfortunately, that is not at presentable stage, and that is these smaller boxes, so the same size as this 67 megaparsec box, looking at gas cooling, effect of a UV radiation field. This is a standard Hart-Madow spectrum. The great thing about this is you can track the mean molecular weight and the ionization fraction self-consistently within the simulation. That turns out to be very, very important for studying the kinetics and Yavuz-Aldovich effect, as I'll discuss. We also have one with star formation and feedback, and as you know, if you've done one feedback model, we have a modified feedback model because the first one didn't work. This stuff I won't have a chance to talk about because it's very hard. The other problem is we have to do it in these tiny boxes because we need very high mass resolution to avoid artificial heating off the dark matter particles. And with small boxes, it's very hard to make statistically meaningful maps. This is important, however, because a large fraction of the signal is coming from things a few times 10 to the 13 solar masses, which are affected by these, you know, other than adiabatic physics. Also, when we got into this game of energy injection, we naively figured, you know, we'd run a couple of models and we'd be done. And then we realized energy injection is an enormous can of worms, and we got ourselves very, very confused. There's a huge parameter space. You can think of a dozen different sensible things to do. And so what we've done is we've started a program of lower resolution simulations, numerous here, with Chris Metzler, trying to search the parameter space of energy injection, and then when we find something we kind of like, we'll go back and do some of these larger simulations with that. The advantage of these is we can knock one of these things out in about a day or two, so it allows you to actually explore parameter space pretty quickly. All right, there's no movie, but here's what slices through the 134A simulation look like. We have the little Harvard shield at the bottom here. This goes against my better judgment, but Volker Springer, our postdoc, just loved having that Latin logo on the bottom of all his simulations. It's what he likes to say. I'm sorry. So what you can see is structure grows, right? This is going from redshift 15 down to redshift 0 in a sequence of slices. It doesn't show up all that brilliantly on the screen. Maybe you can see a lot better on the transparency. There's a huge amount of small-scale structure in this filamentary material. These are extraordinarily high-resolution simulations. They're really fun to play with. It's fun watching this thing form and all the structure. And the point is that we're going to be looking at, you know, mostly these clusters and the surrounding, perhaps, intervening filaments when we look at the SZ maps. Let me just show you the mean mass-weighted temperature versus redshift. The blue line is the sort of standard fiducial model again. You can see that as structure starts forming, it heats up. We come in at around about a third of a KeV today, for those people who do this kind of thing. Almost all of the modern simulations more or less agree on that number for this kind of model. The only group that's currently outstanding is the Chen and Ostreicher group, who get about a factor of three higher than this for reasons that we don't really understand. You can see the smaller box does exactly what you expect. At low redshift, we slightly underpredict because we have a small box. We're missing a few rare hot objects. At high redshift, we start forming structure earlier, so we're a little bit hotter to begin with. Over most of the redshift range of interest for the Sinyazo-Dovich effect, they basically lie right on top of each other. This is the energy injection run, and as you can see, we did serious violence to this model. All of a sudden, the gas got really, really hot, adiabatically cools down, and ends up actually almost indistinguishable at Z equals zero. Don't know if I'll get a chance to talk about it. We spent a lot of time trying to understand kind of semi-analytic approximations once we have the simulations with which to compare them. One of the ingredients into that is cluster mass profiles and gas profiles. Here's the six most massive clusters from our simulation. You probably can't read it. This is radius running from 0.01 to 10 megaparsecs, density on the y-axis. The blue lines are the cold dark matter. The red is the gas. The line that goes through that is an NFW profile. As you can see, it provides a remarkably good fit to the data. The gas is a little bit flatter than the dark matter, but not much. If you put in something like a Moradell profile or even a Hernquist profile, you really can't tell much difference. There's a huge amount of argument going on in the community. They're all arguing about all this stuff off to the left here down below 0.01 megaparsecs that contains epsilon squared of the total mass and is essentially irrelevant to anything, but fun to argue about. I could show you exactly the same thing in the 67 megaparsec box. It looks exactly the same. Here's, you know, one of the most important ingredients for doing the SZ effect is the mass-temperature relation. Here it is shown in the two different boxes. M goes as T to the 3 halves is the prediction that you should follow. This is basically what we found. There's two lines here. Those are the two fits to the red and the blue data points. They're basically statistically completely indistinguishable, both in offset, in scatter, and in slope, indicating we've really converged here. This is the region of interest for simulating the SZ effect. This is where all of your signal comes from. And what I'll show later is that this box is high enough resolution to have really converged in all of this, and we can prove that by showing you this box. Just to show you how big these simulations are, the biggest particle in this box, biggest cluster, has 300,000 particles in it. So that's big, and it's got an amazing amount of substructure and interesting other physics that you can do with this, but let me leave that aside for the time being. Okay, so what do? We want to make maps. We take our map size just by taking the angle subtended by the box at our highest redshift output. Conveniently, that turns out to be 1 degree in the 134 megaparsec run. And then for every nth snapshot, and we vary n to check that we have convergence in sampling the line of sight, turns out if you basically drop one output every light crossing time, you're pretty much roughly right. We dump the gas density, the cold dark matter density, the Y parameter, the Doppler parameter in X, Y, and Z, and we use a Lagrangian method to actually bin up, for example, for the Y parameter, you bin up the pressure times, you know, the Thomson cross-section and everything, times the projection of the SPH smoothing kernel. And that allows you a fully adaptive two-dimensional Lagrangian method for getting very high-resolution maps where you have a lot of particles. And the pressure, of course, is just the electron fraction, the equation of state, mean molecular weight, internal energy. And then what happens is you make all of these planes, you can shift them all around using periodicity, and any map, you just sum them together. That's exactly what Whaley described. And those maps form the basis of the analysis. So let me show you how they look. This is, again, quite similar to what Whaley showed. Starting, now we've done it backwards. It's not all going to fit on there, is it? This is redshift 8, and it runs down to redshift 0. The color scale is shown here, running from 10 to the minus 10 to 10 to the minus 4. This is Y on a log scale. What you can see is most of the signal is coming from redshift 1 to 2. That's basically what we heard in the last talk. There's an enormous amount of very, very small-scale structure. It's really prominent if you stand right up next to the screen like this. You can see the clusters. You can see the filaments. Okay? You sum all of these guys up, and you get an SZ map. In this particular case, if you summed those guys up, you would get a map like this. And this shows one of the first things. It's something that numerous people have pointed out. Whaley mentioned it in the last talk. Voila, all the filaments are gone. You project all of these things up, and you really cannot see a filament. And it's essentially just a projection problem. There's just too much background and foreground stuff. What really does stick out of these clusters, and there's clusters of various sizes at varying distances from you. I can show you, you know, examples of how they come in if you're interested. The range here is 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6, so this stuff is very, very cold. These things are relatively easy to see. Okay. Every now and then you get lucky when you're making one of these maps, and you happen to run right through a cluster. Here's the eighth map we made in one of the boxes. There's a cluster sitting 140 megaparsecs away from the observer, and that's this guy. We got extremely excited because you maybe can't see that in this bright lit room, but there's enormous amount of substructure in that emission. We thought, wow, look at all that cluster substructure. This is fantastic. It's not predicted to be there, but wow, wow. So what we did was we separated out the slice in which you have the cluster, which is this nice, smooth, totally featureless blob, from the slice that contains everything else, and this map is almost completely statistically indistinguishable from all of the other maps we made where we didn't trace right through a cluster. Which just goes to show you that when you start doing things based on the SZ effect, you know, to do with cluster substructure and so on, you can really, you know, get confused by foreground and background. I'm not even going to try and explain those. Okay. This is 1 degree all the way across. This is the brightest pixel on the map. It's not a star, even though it has a little cross edge. So this is, what, around about a sixth of the map or something or other? Maybe it's several arc minutes across. This is 140 megaparsecs away, and it turns out to have a mass of around about, in gas, it's about 10 to the 13 and a half, 10 to the, almost 10 to the 14, something like that. So it's a big cluster. Most of it comes from the cluster, and the substructure that you can see, these little knots, are background clusters, right? Oh, I don't remember the quantitative number. But yeah. It's the brightest thing in the field. It depends what angular scale you're looking at. No, I don't. Unfortunately, this is the brightest pixel on the map, and the color scale is set to that pixel, unfortunately. That's what we kept finding, was the clusters are never the brightest things. It's always that dot in the corner. This is just the average Y as a function of Z. This just brings home the point that was completely obvious from the maps. All the signal is coming in the range redshift 1 to 2. This is the mean over something like 25 maps, and this is the standard deviation, showing you the kind of fluctuations you get map to map. Yeah? It's a distant cluster. Hey, the SZ effect's independent of redshift. It's more, the maps are more uniform. Right? This is sample variance, basically. That was unsmooth, absolutely. Okay, here's, you can just do the dpdy. Smooth with a Gaussian of 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 arc minutes for width half max. Just to set the scale, this is the 95% confidence level upper limit from FIRAS, of course, on a totally different angular scale. But it does let you know that clearly none of these models are going to have any problem whatsoever fitting the FIRAS constraint. I will show you the reheating run fails this test dismally. So this is sort of a to remind you when I get back to that. What's this? What was the question?
Well, you know, FIRAS 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5.
Yeah.
The
right side of the arrow. There you go. All right. Okay. Here's one thing you can do with those maps. You can calculate to angular power spectra. Here's the claim that I believe we've converged. Here's the primary signal. No one cares about that. Here's a bunch of upper limits, which have been missing from all of the data plots up until now, but you can see they're actually in a quite an interesting regime. And then here is the larger boxes in blue and the smaller boxes in red. What you can see is more or less what you'd expect. The smaller box has slightly more small-scale power because it has slightly higher resolution, has a little bit less large-scale power. That turns out to be somewhat artificial. As you watch these maps come in, right, this thing fluctuates up and down. These are one sigma error bars on the mean, so it can fluctuate up and down that much as the new samples come in, just due to the fact that, you know, you're probing a very small volume. When you're looking through these maps, one square degree isn't all that big. So the agreement here is probably a little bit better than it actually looks, but the sense is such, sort of as you'd expect, you're missing rare bright objects in the smaller box. This level of agreement between two curves, if I was, you know, trying to calculate the primary anisotropy, I'd be crying into my beer right now. But for this kind of thing is actually really, really good. I don't think anyone's really demonstrated anything at this level before. Notice that even though you can't see any filaments at all in any of those maps, this is not L squared, right, which is what would happen if it was Poisson. You still see large-scale structure in these maps, and this is essentially the statistical projection of all of those filaments and lower density.
How do you know it's not the division effort that's a late-time object? Like a big cluster is going to have a division error very low. If you fix it upon that shift, you might just do it
elsewhere. We've... If I froze it at redshift of 2, yeah. We can come back to that when we discuss the Presch-Schechter approximations, if I get a chance to talk about it at all. Okay, we also did the kinetic SZ effect. This turns out to be extraordinarily difficult to simulate. For reasons that are in hindsight obvious but were mysterious to us to begin with. Again, we start at redshift 8 and we all the way down to redshift 0. The actual effect is the sum of these things. Now, the problem is the signal can go positive and negative, so this is plotted on a linear scale, making the maps look completely different, even though they're not actually all that different sort of structurally. Again, you see most of the signal comes in this redshift range, sort of 1 to 3-ish. You see lots of little stuff connected up by this filamentary material. As you get out to higher redshift, you start seeing kind of large bulk flows, which are going to be the cause of all our grief later on, here, you know, coming towards us or going away from us. You sum all those guys up and you get a map very, very similar to what Wheelie showed. Here's a kinetic SZ effect map. And the scale here has B is basically delta T on T running from 10 to the minus 5 plus or minus. And it turns out these things are basically just saturated, so they may be a factor of one or two times bigger. If you go through that analysis, you make lots of those maps, and you calculate up the power spectrum here with the upper limits again, you find that it's down a factor of roughly 10 in power, so a factor of about 3 in temperature. And it looks like it has a very, very similar shape to the thermal effect. Part of that is the fact that there are 5 orders of magnitude on the y-axis, and everything looks like a flat line on that kind of scale. In fact, if you plot the ratio of these two things, it varies by factors of 5 or more across the band. So they don't really have the same shape, but they're both kind of flattish. And again, we think that that's sort of converged. Part of the problem with this one is that the kinetic effect is very hard to calculate in the small box. So, okay. I was going to talk about a bunch of approximate methods and how they do, but let me not do that. Let me just talk about the energy injection run. As I said, this was meant to be extreme, and it turned out it was very, very extreme. We ran the same box again, but then at redshift 7, we injected 1 keV of energy. When we ran it all down to redshift 0, here was the mass-temperature relation in the adiabatic run, and here, looking not massively different, is the mass-temperature relation in the injection run, and you think, okay, that looks kind of benign and easy. Everything's a little bit hotter, just like you'd expect. You've added a whole bunch of energy. It turns out we actually did extreme violence to the model. Here's the gas fractions plotted against mass or temperature, depending on how you want to think. F gas is the fraction of gas to dark matter in all of the various objects relative to the cosmic mean density. And you can see you get the normal result in the adiabatic run. You sit around 90-95%. That's, you know, what everyone has always called upsilon or one on upsilon. I can never remember which. We agree more, you know, pretty much with what everyone else has done. And then if you inject a keV of energy, you just blow the gas out of everything that's low mass. That's what we were trying to do. We did really well. It's a fun movie to watch, because as you watch the structure coming together, at redshift 7, all the gas just suddenly goes, you know, in reverse for a while, and then it comes back in again. It was really quite fun. I've got that movie on my laptop if people are desperate to see it. And you can see that there's sort of a flaw down here where 1 keV cooled by the adiabatic expansion is about whatever that is, keV. Okay. Here's a poor man's movie. Thanks. We start off, all these things turn out backwards. Start off up here at redshift 15. Structure begins to form. We then inject the energy. All of this small-scale structure, which you probably can't see on the screen, becomes extraordinarily fuzzed out as the gas suddenly decides it's way too hot to sit in any one small potential well. And then gradually the structure starts forming again. And at redshift 0, it doesn't look too different, except that inside the filamentary material here, there's all these little dots that are no longer there, right? So that's really the only thing that's changed. If you look at the partial maps, oh, I've got all kinds of other things here, let me not show you. If you look at the partial maps, this looks really funny. Here's the cold universe at redshift 8. You cross the redshift 7 boundary, and all of a sudden every gas particle has a keV of energy almost uniformly, and then this gradually cools, and the structure really doesn't start forming until much, much later, right? And if you put it all together, you notice two things. One is that this is a very blurry map. There is not very much small-scale structure. The second thing is that this temperature range that used to be two orders of magnitude before now goes from 10 to the minus 4 to 4 10 to the minus 5 because there's a lower floor, right, to any y. Anywhere you look, you hit some of this hot gas. This was my favorite. This is dy dz. You get quite a big signal from all of that dense, hot gas at high redshift, so much so that when you actually plot up cumulative y for the maps, here it is for the adiabatic run again. This is the older case. It's a very nicely sharped peak distribution at a few times 10 to the minus 5. Remember, the fire ass upper limit is kind of down this way, so this model is definitely ruled out. So we achieved our stated aim. Here's what happens to the CLs when you do this. Okay, so here's the kinetic and thermal effects for the adiabatic run and the energy injection run. The first thing you notice is that this is probably not right. This is almost certainly a finite box size artifact. The problem is that you have a huge amount of gas at a keV that is moving on the scale of the box. Because it's extremely dense and extremely hot, it contributes a lot of signal to the kinetic SZ effect. But of course, the velocities are probing the lowest K modes, right? And so you're totally dominated by finite box effects. And so this is really just bleeding power all the way down from the box scale. And so this is basically completely unbelievable. But the thermal effect is not like that. The thermal effect, you sort of more or less see what you'd expect to get. You obviously get a suppression of small scale power because you've blown all of the gas out of the small halos. And you get an increase of power on large angles because you've managed to heat the gas, right? So the small ripples in the gas at high redshift can give you large angle power, which is this stuff out here. And in fact, if you divide this up by redshift slice, that's essentially what you see. Exactly where this crosses, of course, is going to depend on exactly how much energy you inject, exactly when you inject it, and details like that. Okay. Let me finish up. We have a large suite of simulations, the whole purpose of which was to study the Sinyaev-Zel'dovich effects. We're sort of drowning in data at the moment. I claim we have very good convergence for adiabatic physics. We haven't really been able to demonstrate that for anything beyond adiabatic physics, but it's a good first step. I didn't get a chance to talk about this, but we've been looking at testing and calibrating some of these approximate methods that people have used, which are very easy because you don't have to run all of these large simulations. We've been trying to understand the dependence on energy injection. Our first run was quite extreme, so we have the pipeline set up, but I don't think we really have good, interesting physics results just yet. We have these other runs that are sitting on tape, mass storage. If we can get them off and analyze them, they hopefully will be slightly less extreme. We think the thermal effect is pretty much under control, more or less. The kinetic effect is much harder to calculate because you still require the same high resolution, but you're basically coupling small-scale density fluctuations in with large-scale velocity fluctuations. The velocities are probing smaller k than the densities anyway, and so you end up with this very large-scale, small-scale coupling, which means you need an enormous dynamic range. And we always either run out of resolution or box size. It's also much harder to calculate because the traditional way of doing this is you go back to some point and you say the universe is neutral beyond that. But in fact, of course, if you actually do it, small halos start forming and forming ionized gas. They're quite dense, and that's not a negligible contribution. You have to really worry about that effect if you want to, you know, really show convergence there as well. So that's sort of what we're working on at the moment. Sort of points to take away from this, basically the filamentary material, this cosmic web, is quite hard to see in terms of just looking at a map. The same is true, actually, to answer a question that was posed to Wei-Li. If you look at the X-ray emission from these filaments and you say, take a single slice of the box, you can see a filament, there's no doubt. If you had the sensitivity, it would be fine. But when you stack these guys up, it's the same thing. It just disappears into this general fuzz and you basically can't see anything. Exactly the same thing happens in lensing, anything where you're projecting over a large path length. It's slightly more prominent in the kinetic SZ effect, but of course there the whole signal level is lower, so you win some, you lose some. This line of sight projection actually complicates the interpretation, looking for things like substructure and clusters and so on. And we know that non-adiabatic physics, cooling and preheating, can be important. And what we're trying to do at the moment is get a handle on the extra physics, which is going to sort of make this an interesting question. We've definitely done an extreme model of that. We've had some problems with some of the cooling runs because we have to do it in these small boxes, and they take a really, really long time. But some of them have actually been run through to redshift zero, and we're going to try and start analyzing those in the next couple of weeks. Thanks. No. So you each. So the. Well.
Okay. So this is the question. So what we know is that. So basically, when you go back along the line of sight, how many boxes do you use? Did you just use one box that you?
Yeah, and then you just shift it, right?
Okay. So one of the issues here is that your box size is roughly 200 megaparsecs.
That's right.
Which in fact isn't really enough to go after the
absolutely.
And so this is an issue that, you know, to the extent one wants to do stacking, one wants to get this fixed. Of course, this is an issue for you guys as well, right? Which is the fluctuation level is not trivial.
Yeah, I didn't really get a chance to mention that. It's an excellent point. We looked at this in another context, obviously. I mean, you heard this talk, so you know this. We looked at this in great detail for gravitational lensing. We looked really hard. We looked at the one-point function, the two-point function, the three-point function, and the four-point function, trying to find an effect for this box replication where we could say, aha, everyone else is wrong, we're right. We didn't find anything. I mean, we found very, very good agreement. For all of those things where you're dominated by small-scale power, that's not true of the kinetic SZ effect. So I think in that case, you're absolutely right. The kinetic SZ effect from large-scale superclusters, for example, is going to be a problem. But I think for the thermal effect, where you're basically dominated by, like, that you hit a hot lump or you don't, that's more or less the effect. Once you've got a big enough box that you've got a fair sample of that mass function, you're pretty much fine.
Okay.
That's what we found. So it would be nice to repeat this with more boxes and be able to interleave the boxes. That would be great. I don't know if we can really afford the computer time. We've definitely looked for that effect. So far, we haven't found it. So, all the way in the back.
Can you comment on how well we get questions from students lately? So, before you call your AVAX physics
class,
which has shocks in it, how does NCH compare to the AVAX?
Oh, a religious question. Well, yeah, actually, it's actually kind of interesting. If you take Whaley's highest resolution simulation and you plot not delta T on T for us, but you plot Y, which is, of course, a factor of two smaller, the curves where they publish them more or less agree. So there's almost this factor of four in amplitude, and the shape's very, very close. So in that case, I guess you would say that, you know, we agree quite well, except there's a factor of four in amplitude different. What makes it difficult is that everyone's run a slightly different model. In fact, Whaley's two different runs were of slightly two different models. So what we did was we just picked one model and decided to run all our simulations on that. But it makes it difficult to compare with any other group.
But it doesn't matter how well you capture the shocks.
Right. Well, so we captured the shocks much, much better than the results that Whaley showed, which are a decade old. I don't know precisely why that SPH simulation did as badly as what Whaley showed. We've definitely looked at shock capturing. I mean, once we get some of these science papers written that haven't been written yet, I want to get this code paper out on this new code we've developed to do this. We're finding very, very good shock capturing. I mean, good meaning that we can predict in advance if you're going to use 32, you know, particles to smooth, that's going to be roughly the cube root of that. It's going to be the width of this in one dimension. And so we're getting quite sharp boundaries. And like I said, you know, 300,000 particles in an object, that's quite a lot of groups of 32. So, Laura? We're not sure yet. We're thinking about it. Let me not go out on a limb and give you my half-baked theories. That's a really interesting question. And where you inject it, whether it's kind of more uniform or more concentrated towards the higher density regions, is also a very interesting question. Whether you're injecting it as entropy rather than energy is an interesting question. Under investigation. You don't get the 10 to the minus 4 that we found. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you know, when FireEye came out with their Y limits, this impulsive heating of all the electrons was one of the things they put limits on.
Yes, exactly.
And you're well over that limit.
Like I said, when we first did that, remember, what we wanted to do was we wanted to set up a group of simulations, and we wanted to zoom in on something. And we thought at first that there was a sort of a one-parameter zoom going on here. And then as we got more sophisticated, we realized there's four or five of them, so we stopped. But so what we did was we said zero, and then the other end, so you can start doing bisection, is you make absolutely sure that you've bracketed the root. So we were sure that we'd bracketed the root. And boy, did we bracket the root. So, okay. That's a great question. We have only just started looking into the X-ray side of things. And as yet, what we've been doing is pretty damn crude. But it's a definitely good thing to think about. The problem is it's really low contrast and not very many photons. So my guess is it's going to be really hard. But it's worth looking at, definitely. Yeah? Okay. I mean, yes. It does this. And you probably can't tell the difference unless I flashed the other one up right next to it, which would require me actually finding the other one. But if you know what these NFW concentration parameters are, they all become much less concentrated by a factor of two or more. They become much flatter, and you can sort of see that here. You're getting these nice kind of flattish cores that really weren't present in the other run, which... No, this is the gas. The dark matter halo also gets a little puffier. No, the gas gets the core, right? And the dark matter gets a little bit less concentrated. Let me get the other one up there, which requires looking for it. But the blue is dark matter plus gas, and the red is gas only. That's exactly right. So... they're not the same clusters. Well, this is one of the comments you made about friends of friends and finding groups. Well, yeah. Okay, so this one here that I'm moving around is without the energy injection, and this one is with the energy injection. And, you know, like take this guy, right? This one keeps going up. This one it clearly cores out. And so statistically, if you go through a large number of these things, i.e. greater than 6, you definitely find a trend where you get much flatter profiles in the core, which is exactly what you'd expect because you've just dumped all this energy in. Right. Well, yeah. Okay, so cluster 4 is not exactly... The problem is it changes the masses and everything, right? Because you change the profile. But these two clusters are roughly the same cluster, meaning that not exactly the same particles are in them, but they're in the same place. You know, they were from the same seed. And it's 4.56 versus 3.65 for the concentration. So that's within the kind of scatter that people find, but it's systematically always that way.